Before we get started with today's show, I want to tell you about another great ESPN podcast, ESPN Investigates. Season 2 of the ESPN Investigates podcast is available now. The Running Man tells the story of an obscure former Olympian and alleged serial sexual predator and how a 14-month ESPN investigation brought him out the shadows. More than 50 men were physically abused and mentally manipulated by their coach for over 40 years until they banded together decades later to find justice. Be sure to check it out. You can download and subscribe to ESPN Investigates as well as The Right Time wherever you get your podcasts. Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to The Right Time. My name is Bomani Jones. Thanks for listening wherever you get your podcast. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. It's that time of week where we have a guest joining us now from Slate.com. The one-time fastest 10-year-old in America, Joel Anderson.
What's up? What's up, bro? What up? Hey, you know, last night I started telling people a little bit about my basketball career just to kind of mix it up. You know what I'm saying? Hey, look. I went to the Rice basketball camp 1991. No lie. Coach Scott Thompson, I won so many awards at the end of the camp. He was like, I'm going to see you in 5 years, bro. At the time, I thought, I'm too good. I'm not going no damn Rice. It didn't work out like that for me. But anyway, I got more to my name than being the fastest 10-year-old in the country.
All right. So first of all, I assumed that you were like most football players and could not hoop.
No.
I did not think you could hoop.
So, okay. I could hoop up until I got to high school.
Uh-huh.
I never learned to dribble with my left hand.
Oh, you were just living off athleticism. So you couldn't hoop.
Yeah. I didn't have a jump shot, but I was just fast. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
The way that I played, I was like, I would press you, steal the ball from you, and then score. But, you know, once you start playing against people that are actually skilled, that becomes a little bit more difficult.
You are the classic football player on the intramural team. But there's always an intramural team that's nothing but football players, and they always lose in the semifinals or the finals to the law school. Because the law school has skilled former athletes who were not big enough to play at a higher level, but they still care a lot. Like, they're all hyper-competitive and everything else. And then the football team is just murder on the break.
Oh,
they
yeah.
are murder on the break.
Just athleticism, rebounding, you know what I'm saying, physical. That was me. I was probably, you know, if I had played in high school, I'd have been like a good 5'11 power forward.
Oh, you're that guy.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. You're totally the football player hooping.
I could rebound. You know what I'm saying? I'll tell a funny story. You and I both know Mike LeBlanc. Every time we talk on this podcast, we talk about Michael LeBlanc, who was the Houston Area Player of the Year in 1996. He went to my high school, Houston Straight Jesuit. I transferred into Straight my sophomore year. I'm still thinking I'm good at basketball. You know what I'm saying? So I'm just like pressing up on people. You know what I'm saying? Just being athletic. I'm right up on Michael LeBlanc, and I swear, dog, I'd never seen somebody this tall. Like, all of a sudden, he was behind me and it dunked on me. That never happened to me in my life. And I was like, you know what? I don't know if I'm going to be playing basketball here, dog.
I mean, hold on, though. You was at Willow Ridge the year before, right?
No. My life is crazy. I went to Bel Air High School.
Oh, okay. See, I was about to say, Willow Ridge would have told you that you wasn't no hooper.
You know what? Because, Willow Ridge was something totally different. That's right. I think I got there maybe. I was there. Yeah, I would have been there around that time that they won state.
They won state your sophomore year because it was my freshman year.
There you go. Yeah, Ansu Cisse, Jay Will, all them guys. Yeah, that was different. I did not have any respect for Straight Jesuit when I went over there either because that's not a school
right.
I've not heard anything about. So I'm just like, I'm not going to let this dude. He ain't going to get around me. And all of a sudden, I looked up and that dude's dunking on me, bro.
Yeah, little did you know that the second best player on Straight's team was like an 8-year NBA veteran by the time it was done.
Actually, it's funny you say that. I mean, Jake Voskuhl was in high school maybe the third.
Third, right, because y'all had Calvin Murphy Jr.
Calvin Murphy Jr., yeah, bro. They were raw. They were real good. I got to admit.
So this is one thing. Me and Joe wind up talking about this once or twice a week. Like, when we just start going through memory lane, like, this is, like, the ultimate we getting old now activity, which is, like, going through the high school players who we just swore was going to make it, right? Like, I always feel like our discussions about that are a real testament to just how good you have to be to make it as a pro. Because I tell people all the time, you think about whoever the boss was at your school or whoever the boss was in your city. That dude probably didn't make the league because when we were kids, there wasn't no rivals. There wasn't no scout. There wasn't no 24/7. We didn't have recruiting stuff. We had the newspaper, right? Yeah. The dudes that was killing it and racking up yards you read about them in the newspaper.
Right, right.
Most of them dudes, 1 year later, was reading the newspaper about the stars.
Because first of all, and I mean, I heard you talk about this last episode. I mean, a lot of dudes just couldn't even get into college. You know what I'm saying? Their career ended at high school. Or, yeah, I mean, they just would not, what we thought. You know, I'll never forget, in a summer league, I played with a guy at Madison. His name was Leonard Robinson. I thought this dude was the best basketball player I ever saw, you know, up to that age. I mean, he made first team all district, didn't even go to college nowhere to play ball, man. But I thought that dude was so cold. I was like, how could anybody be better than Leonard Robinson, dog? But nah, shout out to Leonard Robinson from Madison, class of 95. What's up?
Yo, there's so many of those where it was just like, what do you mean? Like, I was talking about, I don't know if you ever remember Bernard Smith. He went to Conroe.
Yeah, and I never saw him play, but I remember his first team.
Okay. Okay, I saw Bernard Smith play. It was probably his first varsity game. It was the first game of the year, his sophomore year. The idea to me that dude, like, he played a little bit at Texas, and that was it. Like, I saw Steven Jackson play the year before I saw Bernard Smith play, and I was sure that Bernard Smith was a better player than Steven Jackson was. Steven Jackson was on a team with a dude named Keith Harris, who went to Tulane, and I thought that he was better than Steven Jackson. Steven Jackson never played a minute of college ball and had like a 15-year NBA career. I don't know whatever happened to Keith Harris.
I mean, man, that's crazy. Well, you know, do you ever remember the guy, Bobby Crawford? So he played at Eisenhower, and he went to Michigan during that time when they had the Fab Five. So I thought Bobby Crawford was the best player. You know, I went, saw him play at Rice. Oh, Bobby Crawford, cold as hell. Went to Michigan, didn't play, ended up back at Rice. And I'm just like, man, how could that guy not have gone to the league?
Right.
I thought he was so good.
You know, like, even like football players that were, you know, especially in Houston, because it's Houston, right? So we figure in, like, if you're the man playing in Houston, you know, no, it didn't.
Darryl Bush going to go to the league, dog. He ran for 2,000 yards as a senior. You ran for 2,000 yards in Houston. That's amazing.
Yep. He went to Baylor. That was when it was wild. With all these dudes that was cold as hell in Houston, and they all wound up going to like Baylor. And we were like, yo, what's going on? There was one dude, though, that turned out to be every bit as cold as he appeared to be to us.
And he went to Baylor?
No, didn't go to Baylor, but just was in Houston at that time.
Ooh, who?
Yo, you know who I'm thinking about.
Not Ben.
David Boston.
Ben Boston. Yeah.
David Boston was, like, people don't get it. David Boston was cold as hell hooping. He was the quarterback. And I think he went to Humble, right? He was cold as hell at that. Like, David, and then next thing you know, you look up in the Rose Bowl. Here's David Boston winning the Rose Bowl with a touchdown catch as a freshman.
Head to head against Charles Woodson, by the way, too. You know what I'm saying? Like, it ain't like Charles Woodson shut him out when they played against each other. That's how cold David Boston was.
And that was before he was like 275 pounds playing wide receiver, before he just took it too far.
I mean, he was like one of those very first, like, big 6'4" 215 guys in college. And you're like, oh man, Dave Boss kind of, you know, he's gonna be rocked up. Then all of a sudden, man, I mean, that was outrageous what he was doing. That was, I don't know who his trainer was, but he needs to get a refund on that, dog.
Yo, I feel like David Boston actually messed up DK Metcalf's money. Right? Like, wait to bring it back into current times to the people who are not from Houston. Seriously, because the thing was, David Boston got so big that it was just like, you have no business playing wide receiver, right? Like, you did, this is just not what you're supposed to do. And with Metcalf, I was not sold on Metcalf coming out of college because A, he was not actually a very good college football player. And B, as much as everybody marveled at his size, I was like, no, actually, this dude's a little bit too big. Like, he too rocked up.
Right. Just the ability to, it's not about going north and south, it's being able to have some shiftiness, getting it out of your brakes and all that sort of stuff. Could he do that?
But what he can do, he can run sevens. And he can run with sevens, eights, and nines, right? Like, he can run those routes, and he's the number two receiver.
Right.
So that's all he has to do is run these seven. Like, Tyler Lockett is the man. Like, he's one of these dudes that we just forget about when we talk about, like, the best receivers in the league. Tyler Lockett is a boss. And so all DK Metcalf got to do is just go over there and be big and fast.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, what would be, like, the kind of the proto-Alvin Harper? You know what I'm saying? Alvin Harper's a fast dude. You know what I'm saying? He wasn't number one, but he was a hell of an athlete. Beat people deep. I mean, DK Metcalf, man. That, if anything, shows you how bad the coaching was at Ole Miss, though. I mean, AJ Brown, DK Metcalf, y'all couldn't get nothing more out of those guys than that when they were there?
Well, weren't they probationed up by then, right? Weren't they, like, paying the price for all the stuff that had happened before?
It's hard to keep up with how many probations Ole Miss be on, man.
No, man. They like, look, there's some places where it's just kind of hard to win fair and square.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you got to commit some crimes sometimes.
Right. Like that, but that's the thing about us being from Texas and being from Texas from the time that we are from Texas, when the Southwest Conference was the Wild Wild West. And it's a bunch of schools that can't win play-in fair.
Right. The only school in the Southwest Conference that by the time it ended that had not gone on probation was Rice. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
And we not talk about like the little probation you get because y'all's practices was running too long. Right.
Right.
Like that's how Nebraska went on probation for buying the kids extra books. You know, like we not talk about that kind of probation. We talk about like at TCU where everybody was getting paid and the coach is like, I guess I have to tell on us now. SMU been on probation like 6-7 times. Or something like that.
The crazy thing about Pony Excess, the 30 for 30, is that, yeah, I mean, SMU got caught, man. But, I mean, if you hear the story, it's because everybody else was cheating, bro. I mean, yes. They just happened to be the ones that get the hammer put on them. But, I mean, everybody else was doing it.
Well, yeah, everybody was doing it. But the hammer came to SMU not because they got caught, but because they got caught the second time. They got caught running a massive payroll.
Right.
And then we're like, yeah, but a deal is a deal.
Right. Right.
Like Pony Excess, if you have not seen it, mm-hmm. Pony Excess is an incredible film just to watch and get an appreciation of what, like, this is what college football is. This is how it works. And especially how it worked in the 1980s. Cause like, I guess there's people that's too young to remember the Southwest Conference. The thing about the Southwest Conference was this, it was all Texas schools and Arkansas up until 1992. Right. So Texas A&M, SMU, TCU, Texas Tech, Baylor, Rice, and the ultimate wild card, the University of Houston, the school that scares Texas to death like no other school can. Because if they ever got into a big conference, it's cancel Christmas for everybody.
Right. And U of H got into the Southwest Conference late, too.
Yeah. 1976.
Right. Yes.
Yeah. Well, Houston is like, whatever it takes to be bigger, we're going to do it. Like Texas is in the AAC paying like a $5 million coach. When they would have got Dana Holgerson. Texas is like, you know what would make us good? Black guys. Nobody else uses black guys. Like, you know, like they were the first school to integrate in that part of the country,
right,
to integrate in football and basketball.
Right. Well, I mean, consider that like Michigan State had a pipeline into Texas in the 50s and 60s. You know yes. what I'm saying?
Yes.
So, I mean, that's how bad it was. I mean, you know, that nobody else really was willing to take a chance to break that color line.
Like, Houston, we invented the option.
Yeah, that's
like
true.
They legitimately, they were like Bill Yeoman, yep, invented the veer, right?
Right.
And then Bill Yeoman ultimately went down because he was still coaching in the 80s. Mm-hmm. And they said that he was handing out the envelopes in the locker room himself.
My kind of coach. My kind of coach. I was like, you know what I'm saying? You know, cut out the middleman. You know what I mean?
Yes. He's like, I want these boys to know I appreciate it.
But wait a minute, we're talking about the Southwest Conference, and I just want to talk. Have we talked about 33 to 31 yet, or do you want to talk about 33 to 31?
Is that the TCU-Texas game?
Yeah, you forgot it already?
Well, that's the thing about it is, if you are a TCU fan, you remember scores like that. Like, those things are, like, particular to you.
Y'all trying to forget it.
I'm just saying, like, I remember stuff like 70-3, right? Like, when Texas beat Colorado in the Big 12 championship game. Like, them the kind of numbers that I remember. Like, let me think of some other numbers I remember at Texas. Yeah, like 2005. Okay. That's a number that I remember.
I remember 66-3, you know.
Yeah, I know, but what that got to do with TCU? You know what I'm saying? that's all I'm asking. You know what else you remember? The Conference USA, the WAC.
Did we go to
I think you did.
Yeah, we were in the WAC, then we were in the Conference USA, and then we were in the Big East for like a week.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. That's right. That's right. Y'all orphans. You know what I'm saying? Don't nobody want y'all.
Hey, man. Because they didn't want to compete. It's like University of Houston. You know what I'm saying? Nobody want to compete against. I mean, look, the thing is that I bet if they had to do it all over again, they probably would not let TCU into the Big 12. If they had a better option, first of all, if A&M had not left, it wouldn't have happened in the first place.
Correct.
But I wonder if they think now they're like, oh, that was a mistake. We didn't need TCU.
It's ultimately going to be something that hurt everyone and helped no one.
Right.
I guess it'll help TCU because they get more bread.
Mm-hmm.
But especially after Patterson, he's losing his luster. After Patterson get up out of there, I don't know what y'all going to do.
No, but because this is a good question. Because it actually, when this first came up and they were like, well, TCU is going to go into the Big 12. Do you want that? And I said, well, sort of. Because I was like, I enjoy going 11-2 and having an argument about whether or not we deserve inclusion in the playoff or whatever, right? But I was like, when you go to the Big 12, are you going to be as happy going 7-5 and 8-4? Like, I was like, it's like, it's just not possible the way TCU is set up, as much as I care about my alma mater. It's just not possible for them to go 11-1 every year in the Big 12. It's just not going to happen. They're not going to out-recruit everybody. And so, are you going to be okay with it? Now you see people are getting a little restless.
Well, that's what I say about Arkansas being in the SEC. Like, Arkansas, Missouri, Nebraska, like, all those schools that left the Big 12, I'm like, I get why you did it, but y'all ain't going to have fun.
You can understand why Arkansas thought they would do better, right? In 1992, they probably were a little cocky. You know what I'm saying? We can go right over there and roll with them boys.
Yeah, and they still had memories of, like, national championships and top 10 finishes and stuff like that. Like, I see why they thought they would be able to do it that way. And I get why, like, I understand why Nebraska made the move that they made.
Yeah.
I'm just saying, none of, like, Texas A&M, you're not going to tell me that y'all are having as much fun over there as you would. Texas A&M, they just like, it don't matter where you put us, we going to be an 8-win school. And and it is also worth noting, this happened with A&M. Mm-hmm. This happened with Mizzou. I guess this also happened with Nebraska. They could get a caliber of player recruiting in the Big 12. They did better with Big 12 players in their new conferences than they did with the players that they are recruiting in those conferences.
Well, like Missouri, remember? I mean, Missouri, same difference. I mean, they had a pipeline into the DFW area.
Yep.
And then they surprised everybody competing in the SEC East so well those first
won it twice.
Right. And then all of a sudden, that pipeline kind of dried up. I mean,
that was it.
Who would a Texas kid go to Missouri for now?
You know? No, and now the question becomes, why would anybody go to Missouri?
Yeah.
Right? Like, their real estate, Arkansas's problem is, people are like, well, you can do all right at Arkansas, it's close to Texas, but the part of Texas it's close to doesn't have football players. You know, so you can't really do that. That's what Missouri borders. Like, Missouri borders a bunch of places that don't produce football players. Why in the world would I go there to play football? And now Nebraska, now that they can't get the same boys that they used to be able to get, and now they can't go to Texas because they was able to keep it afloat going to Texas. But now, and now that nobody's old enough to remember that Nebraska was ever good.
Oh, my God. Yeah, seriously. I mean,
they were good all the time.
In our lifetime, going up, like, pretty much through college, right? It all fell apart for them post-Eric Crouch. Miami did them dirty. Was that the Rose Bowl?
It was the Rose Bowl.
It's like, oh, y'all just don't have the talent. Y'all don't have the talent anymore. It's not going to work out.
Yo, and remember, like, in the evolution of Nebraska football, I was looking this up the other day. In the 80s, they lost a lot of those big bowl games because they were always finishing first or second in the Big Eight. Like, they might lose one other game other than the Oklahoma game if they were going to lose one. But they stayed going to these bowl games, and they stayed playing against these Florida teams, and they stayed getting beat, right? So you think about, like, in 83, they lost to Miami. I want to say they got a Fiesta Bowl or another Orange Bowl that they lost to Florida State. They lost to Miami in 88 in the Orange Bowl. They lost to Miami in 91 in the Orange Bowl. And then in 93, that first Florida State National Championship, they lost, but they only lost by 3 points.
Right.
I think it was 2 points, but that was the margin. Then those next 2 years, they went down to the Orange Bowl and beat Miami.
Yep.
And then the next year, they went and blew Florida's doors off.
Oh, my God. Tommy Frazier. I mean, was that the game also that Lawrence Phillips had come back?
Yes, he was. Yes, he was. Yeah, they didn't need to compromise themselves. They had Amon Green.
I mean, dog, it was absurd that they brought him back that year. I mean, first of all, what Lawrence Phillips did then happened today, he would have been kicked out of school.
That moment.
Yeah, right. It wouldn't even been an option. It'd be like, hey, you can't come back here. I don't know where you're going, but you can't come back here.
Yeah.
And I remember the words that people used about Nebraska in those years. They're like, well, they've just started to recruit a little bit more speed. You know what I'm saying? They got to bring a little bit more speed in. You know what
I'm saying? but I think legit that's what it was, though, for them, right? Like, there was a level, they were running out of eyebone, and there was a level of talent that they just did not have. And then for that run, they did what they had to do.
Right.
They ramped it up. And then they were still rolling through the end of the 90s. And then they got their doors blown off by that Miami team. And they were like, let's think about this for a second. Like, how are we going to go about this? And then when I was watching that game, a little bit of that game last night. It was Ohio and Central Michigan. And I don't know if you noticed, but Frank Solich is still coaching at Ohio.
Rolling.
They're
doing pretty good, man. I don't know why I went to Ohio University a couple years ago for some reason. I cannot remember. Oh, I thought I spoke to a class there. And I saw their little stadium and Frank Solis. Yeah, I was like, okay, you know, good to see Frank.
Nebraska fired him. They were like, look, man, we got to move into the future. And they were right. And they still waiting. They have yet to make it to the future.
But, and you know what? I bet you they realize now, Bo Pelini wasn't that bad. You know, they're like, yeah, Bo Pelini.
Oh, yeah, that's cool. That's because you ain't got to put up with him.
Right, exactly.
like that's the thing. Bo Pelini wasn't so bad, but the Texas players were gone. Like, the thing with Bo Pelini is, this is what they got at LSU now. The only way that you're happy when Bo Pelini's your coach is if you win, and if you win a lot. If you stop winning even a little bit, you just look around and be like, man, our coach is at.
Right. Why is he,
like, that's just how, that's how he, people receive him.
Right. Right. It's like, why is he here now? He ain't going to make it another year at LSU. Not like this.
He might not make it another game. Like, you know, he's cheeks. Now, let me ask you this, because you and I are both big college football fans and we're both still watching it. And it took a while for me to, like, get up to speed. I don't know if up to speed is the right way to put it. But it took me a while to, like, I'm kind of in the rhythm of doing it because it all seems so strange. And I never thought that this thing would, like, really happen. And now we're in the teeth of it. And it's starting to feel uncomfortable again. Like, this Wisconsin situation where they got, like, 20-something dudes that got it.
Bro, just this week, I mean, so Louisville had to cancel. I had to postpone this game against Virginia. And I'm like, it's one of the things that they sold us on when they brought college football back was that they'll be safer on campus here. We've got these protocols. We'll be able to manage any outbreaks or whatever, if there are outbreaks. And it just hasn't worked out like that. Like, as soon as the Big Ten got started, like you said, Wisconsin, things started to fall apart. And it looks like before the Pac-12 can even get started, I felt like it was all a ruse. They knew that once they started playing, that it was harder to stop. But once they got started, that everybody would be compelling them to complete the season.
Did you see that dude from Clemson who was like, he caught it, I think, in March or something like that, and he basically couldn't get his breathing right until a few weeks ago?
Yeah, that's terrifying, man. What Coach Orgeron told us at one point, he thinks his whole team had. You know what I'm saying? I'm like, yeah. So, okay, these coaches are often the highest paid, and they've overseen these, like, massive failure of protocol. Why are they not facing any real scrutiny for being as bad at this?
Right.
You know what I mean? Because I just feel like, well, man, you said you would be able to manage this. Clearly, you have not been able to. So now what?
Well, you know, part of it for me is, I know coaches always want to coach football. Like, that's always going to be it. Coaches going to want to coach football. But this wasn't their idea. Like, this money has got to be made. They are just trying to get on television as many times as they can and then get the checks for being on television. Like, I think that there needs to be some level of scorn given to the coaches just because I'm not the one that decided to put them out in front on this. So, like, if they're the ones that you decide that's going to be out front, then they're the ones that, you know, need to get the attention for whatever it is. But, hey, man, let's see how Trevor Lawrence looks for the rest of the year. You know, because I said this about the NFL. I was like, your worst case scenario for what happens in the face of this virus is Patrick Mahomes catches it and is never the same.
Right.
Like, that's an option and possibility for a lot of people, that they're going to wind up having this and not being the same short term or maybe even long term.
But Monty, Raquel Armstead, that running back at Jacksonville, man.
Yeah.
He's been hospitalized twice.
Twice.
Twice. That's an NFL football player, bro. Is as healthy of a human as you would imagine could exist. And he's been hospitalized twice. I mean, first of all, just the idea that we expect them, and I've heard you talk about this, that these guys get sick and then we just expect them to get back to normal. You know what I'm saying? Just get back out. Yep. All right, they healed up. They're ready to get back out there and they should be able to go. But, I mean, it doesn't always work like that. We don't know for sure that Trevor Lawrence is going to be ready to go when it's time to suit him back up.
Mm-mm. And, I mean, that, it's all so much. Like, there may be a point where we look back 10 years. Like, somebody's going to do some study, like, 10 years from now. And they're going to look at what the effects were of this virus and what is untold. And we're going to hear about some people that got it or had it that we hadn't heard nothing about previously. You know, as more information manages to come out. And by the way, from the looks of things, we might still be living this life in a year.
Right.
And so that's where we are. But now we're going to figure out, like, the NBA, they got to figure out what to do because they need to get into arenas.
Right.
Because they need the money from being in the arenas.
Right.
But how many people are they going to be able to get in? And I think where the NBA is going to get themselves to is, themselves, how many people are they going to allow to come? Like, I remember when they showed those shots from that game at Kyle Field against Florida, and I just could not believe how many Aggies were crammed into that thing.
It was crazy, bro. I mean, I'm still shocked that people want. Well, I guess I shouldn't be shocked that people want to go to these games, right? Because there is a sense of normalcy. It is routine. It is like, you know, a part of the tradition, particularly regionally in the South, to be at a football game in the fall. But I mean, in the NBA, it's going to be a lot different. You think people are going to be filling up Portland's arena? You know what I'm saying? You think the Warriors are going to bring people into the Chase Arena and fill that out in the middle of a pandemic? At a time when we know that the numbers are getting worse. Like, what is it, yesterday that we had our highest number?
Yes.
We're recording this on Thursday. So yesterday, we had our highest number of infections recorded in the country.
Yep.
Like, when we first shut everything down, it was so much less worse than it is today.
Yes.
I mean, and we are just thugging our way through it.
Yeah. Well, it's like at that time, I feel like they shut it down because they're like, yo, we don't know anything about this. We need to find some things out. And I feel like everything I found out has been terrible. And as a result, it has made me want to stay indoors even more. And now, like, nobody's going to have the heart to say out loud, Thanksgiving's kind of got to be canceled, guys.
Ooh.
And it's not just simply going to be that everybody is under the same roof. It's going to be everybody dipping a spoon into the same bowl to get to dressing, right? Everybody reaching a fork onto the same plate to get the turkey.
Yep.
Like if you go to Thanksgiving at somebody's house, if anybody got it, all about to have it.
Are you going to go home for Christmas?
No, I don't think.
See, I'm torn. I mean, look, man, I mean, both of you, our parents are elderly. How many more months can we not go? And that's going to be the real turmoil that people are picking between, right? Like,
right.
We know that this is probably not going to be over even by the end of next year. So is there a way to do this safely and responsibly?
Yeah, like you'd have to like do some like get testing, get quarantined, mm-hmm. you know, kind of stuff or whatever it is. Like it would take a measure of effort to get done and nothing winds up being foolproof. Like all of those things, I don't have an answer for that. And this economy does not have an answer for what to do because nobody's going to say what really needs to be said, which is we got to lock it down for Christmas, man.
Bro.
And I mean the Christmas shopping. Like that's going to be the thing about it is people are going to be a lot more in these stores mm-hmm. and making these moves and everything else. And to be fair to everybody out here, it's been rough. And with it being rough, people feel like they need this holiday.
Yeah, man.
They've earned this holiday. They deserve this reprieve from everything that we've been dealing with. I 100% get where they're coming from, but it's going to be all bad in the end.
Right. And just imagine to go through one of the toughest years that any of us have ever gone through in the course of our life and to not be able to spend it with family or friends.
Right.
Like that just compounds the misery of how bad things are. But I mean, how much worse? I mean, we've read so many stories. I wrote a story months ago about a family that celebrated their grandmother's birthday. She died of coronavirus and four other people in the family died of coronavirus just off them going by her house just to visit, just stop by and say happy birthday, man. And it's just like, that's the sort of, you do not want that to be you. You do not want that to weigh on you. But I understand why people are willing to take these risks because ultimately, like we're all cut off from the people we love and the people we care about in a time we need the most. And so I'm trying not to put too much judgment on it because it's something that I'm grappling with too, but it's just like, man, the smart thing to do is to tell everybody, man, you need to stay your ass at home.
Yeah, well, sometimes you can't do stuff, man.
Yeah.
That's just really kind of, and I think part of where we are in this is people's refusal to acknowledge that sometimes you can't do stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Like people resent the idea that they being told that they can't do something.
Right. That's why we have football right now.
Yep.
We refuse to accept that these are unprecedented times, dangerous times, and that things are going to have to change. Our routines are going to have to change. Our lifestyle is going to have to change. And we're just like, no, man, this is just what it's going to be. This is what we have to do. And this is what we always have done. And that's just not really a smart response. And that is why we are seeing these numbers go back up the way that they have.
Like, folks don't get it, right? Like, on my end, at least, people like me, you think we rooting against the money that powers this company?
Right.
Like, are you looking at the news today? Have you heard about what's going on around these parts today? Like, people need to understand this. Nobody that works here stands to gain from there being no football.
Yes.
Nobody does, right? And that's why we here.
Right.
It's because nobody stands to gain, you know, from doing that. But that's why, like, a company like this feels the way that it does. It sells football games. So therefore, they want there to be football games. But these other people that's out here about this football, it's just a matter of principle to them.
Yeah, right.
And they're just like, nah, we want some football.
So Texas Tech I think, is one of the few schools in the country that is allowing tailgating on campus, whatever. And it is, at least according to one of the articles I read in Texas Tribune, that it is that they're tracing the outbreaks in Lubbock to some of the, you know, to some of the activities still going on Texas Tech because of this sort of stuff. And I'm like, bro, it is not necessary for you to have tailgating right now. I'm sorry. No. I mean, also for Texas Tech football, come on, bro. I mean, what are you, you know what I'm saying? This ain't the Mike Leach, you know, heyday or something like that. This ain't, you ain't going to see Michael Crabtree.
No.
You know what I'm saying? So
Byron Hanspar, they walking through that door.
Yeah, right. You know what I'm saying? I'm sorry, James Gray is not there anymore, bro. You know what I'm saying? Zebby Lethridge is not coming through that door. So I don't understand. I understand why people are doing it, but you're right. I mean, a lot of people, this is just that want to, and because they want to do it and they think they deserve it because times have been hard, they're going to keep showing up. But we're going to continue to pay this price until people, you know, wise up on this.
Did you see the Sports Illustrated story that Ross Dellinger did about the dedication them LSU folks got to this tailgating, where they was like breaking out like city maps and property lines and everything else to find where it was that they could go that would not be within the orders of the city of Baton Rouge? You know, and all of that stuff.
I did not see that. No.
For all the jokes that we have about that Louisiana work ethic, they was on their grind to go find a way to die. Like they was working really, really hard to go find where it was that they could set up and they could have their tailgates. And look, man, Louisiana tailgates are a different animal, man. They be eating good as hell. And you know, again, they more dedicated to kicking it to anybody.
Man, I'll tell you, one of my favorite Louisiana experiences was covering a state semifinal game in St. James Parish. Now, the head coach of the team I was covering at the time, Calvary Baptist, Doug Peterson. So the Philadelphia Eagles, Doug Peterson. And we went down there, and they were tailgating. School had not lit out for the day, but there were people on the lawn of this high school at like 2 o'clock in the afternoon selling Gator, Jambalaya. Yo, but it's a high school game, bro. It was so live, Bomani. It was so dope. And it was a good game. One of the Booty Brothers.
If it was that era, it's either Josh. No, it's probably John David.
No. This was for my Shreveport people. So Evangel split up. The Booties went to this other school called Calvary Baptist.
Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah, they started Calvary Baptist. And so the Booties went to Calvary Baptist. And so this was Jake Booty, who didn't end up even playing football in college because he was like 5'9", 5'10". He was cold, but he was, you know, a little undersized. And I don't think he really wanted to play football like that at the next level. But he was really good, led him to the state semis. And they lost that game. But yeah, man. Yeah, things changed in Shreveport. In fact, for my Shreveport people, Evangel is winless this year.
Wow.
Yeah, they just fired their coach.
Yeah, and for people, Evangel is one of these perpetual football powers. Just always good. Yeah, Brock Berland, he went there like this, always good. And then if you remember Josh Booty or John David Booty, and I feel like there's another Booty that I'm forgetting. And yes, Booty, B-O-O-T-Y.
It was Abraham Booty?
Yeah, it was either, I can't remember if it was Abram or Abraham, but yeah. It was a Booty.
Right.
Yo, like, have you ever been, do we know anybody else's whose name is Booty? Because, like, I feel like African-Americans with their last name Booty, somebody would have changed that up. They wouldn't have been that much pride.
I'm surprised it actually isn't a black name, but you know that there's another Booty out there now, you know, right?
It's like a grand Booty, right? Like, it's the next generation of Booties?
General Booty.
There is General Booty. I forgot about General Booty.
Yeah. General Booty Cole, too. He's going to be a top recruit next year, I think. I think he's a junior this year, so.
But do you think the Booty family, like when they name that boy General Booty, like do they not hang around the right people? Or like it ain't no jokes in their world about your last name being Booty?
I think they think that there's more upside to being General Booty in the long run. They playing the long game.
Yeah.
If one of them blow up, then you got something. You know what I'm saying?
I feel like this too. You name your kid General Booty, I know exactly what you did on Tuesday. I could be mistaken on this one, but I feel pretty confident that I know if you, whoever raised General Booty, I know what box they checked.
I'm trying to, I know Josh Booty because I talked to Josh Booty for a story about Nick Saban, because Josh played for Nick Saban when he was at LSU, if
right.
you remember. So I can't remember which Booty. It's not John David. It's probably Abram Booty's son. I think that's him. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Anyway, they are a kind of an inscrutable family, but obviously they're evangelical. You know what I'm saying? They do the evangelical things. So I would imagine, yes.
And we just enjoy saying booty over and over again.
When it comes down to it, I never left middle school, dog. You know what I'm saying? I mean, you know, if he was my friend, he'd have to hear it all day long. I'm sorry.
Yeah, how much you think Abram Booty resents the fact that when you go to Abram Booty in the wiki, it just redirects you to Josh Booty's?
Does it really? Oh, man, that's so disrespectful.
Yeah, I didn't realize Abram Booty made it to the league as a wide receiver.
He didn't play in Major League Baseball either?
Josh was the baseball player.
Josh was a baseball player? Okay.
Yeah, Josh was a baseball player. So Abram Booty played receiver at LSU for 3 years, and then he went to Valdosta State, and then he went and played for the Browns. John David Booty is the one that went to USC. Mm-hmm. He ain't really getting nothing cracking.
He did okay. He did all right.
Yeah, it was all right. I mean, but it wasn't what they thought it was going to be.
Nah, it was towards the end of that Pete Carroll, you know, when it kind of all started to fall.
Yeah, he was. Well, no, I mean, they were good. Mm-hmm. That 2008 team, no, he did not quarterback the 2018. Mark Sanchez did.
That was Sanchez.
And that team was one of the best ones that Pete had. They just lost a weirdo game going to Oregon State on like a Thursday night.
Quiz Rogers, man.
Boy, I tell you, that's a dude you don't want to fight. I guarantee you. That Mud Alley plus 5'7".
Yeah. Yeah, I'm saying, man, them boys are. It's a little different out there, you know what I'm
saying? Yes, it is. By the way, before I forget, I can tell the people, I forgot you had announced this. Now, Joel's at Slate These Days, and Joel did the Slow Burn podcast last year on Biggie and Tupac. It was this year, right? It was in 2020 that you did that.
Well, so yeah, we did it at the end of last year, and then we had the live show.
Right, live show was
when my boy Bomani showed up, did the live show with us in New York. You know what I'm saying?
That sounds, it just feels like so long ago. Like it had to hit me to be like, wow, that was actually 2020. But you got a new season coming up. Tell the people what it's going to be.
Yeah, man. So as it is, I'm going to be doing season 6 of Slow Burn, and we're going to do it on the 1992 LA riots. If they happen today, you probably would call them the LA Uprising, right? You know, we announced that last week, and I'm just really excited to do it, man. I wanted to start doing it in the middle of putting together season 3, to be honest, because episode 2, we kind of run through the conditions that gave birth to like Tupac and Death Row Records, you know, LAPD systemic harassment of Black and Brown communities, deindustrialization that led to skyrocketing unemployment, and then the crack epidemic and all this other stuff. And I was like, man, it just seems like there's a lot to do here. And this is before the national reckoning we had this summer, right? You know, so I wanted to do it then, but then it just seemed that much more urgent to do. So, yeah, man, I'm going to start working on that early next year, assuming we get to next year.
I'm looking forward to it because, like, I normally listen to podcasts on, like, sped up, you know what I'm saying? And so everybody sounds not like high-speed dubbing, but everybody, you know, sounds a little faster. But I don't know if it'll be more fun listening to this in regular speed, or if it'll be more fun to listen to it in high speed, because it's going to be a whole lot of LA accents. And the LA accent is one of my favorites because they don't realize that they have an accent, right? Like they have no idea that they talk hilariously. And I just can't wait to hear, hey, cuz, look, hey, man, look here, cuz, look here.
More
man.
Kids, you know what I'm saying? Yeah.
Yo, man, go in the kitchen, man, give me some of that Kool-Aid.
Man, I don't know who it is. Did you watch The Wood? Well, homeboy that plays Stacy's brother, I don't know who he is, the dude that was a gangster or whatever. Like, that dude had, like, the perfect, whatever I think of the L.A. accent, is that dude right there.
Man, I went to college with this dude. He was from Pomona, which, you know, before I knew anything about California, was L.A., because it's all L.A., right? But for purposes of this discussion, it is L.A. So, he is from Pomona, and he used to always lock himself out of his room. His room was next door to my homeboy's room. And you could go out the window of my homeboy's room and there was like a roof landing, right? And so you could go out, go around the roof and then come in through the window because otherwise you had to pay like $3 or something like that for a lockout. So one day, old buddy comes in, high as a Georgia pine. He walks in, his eyes super red and he's like, hey, you know, what's going on, homie, right? And he's like, he's about to go out the window, but the RA happened to be in there kicking him. And the RA is like, can't go out the window. He's like, hey, homie. Say, homie, what you trying to say, homie? You're not going to let me get in my house, homie? You're going to charge me to get in my house, homie? That's what this is, man. You're going to charge me to get in my house? Like, he was just going. I shouldn't have to pay money to get in my house, homie. Right? He may even say, cuz, in retrospect, right? Like, you know, like you can't even charge me to do that. And then at some point, like, there was a dresser that you kind of needed to stand on in order to make the window hop. Mm-hmm. But something happened, and he was high, and he didn't do the two and two. And I just remember that as he's going on in his rant, he steps up on the dresser, and when he stands up, and he gets high enough that he, like, hits his head on the ceiling. And so And so as he's doing this, like, you gonna charge me, get in my house? And he goes up and it's bow. And he goes, oh, God, these AM. And then went right back. And he's like, man, you ain't gonna charge me, get in my house. Oh, God, these AM. And then finally the RA says, you can go ahead. And he's like, all right, good looking. And then he just disappears into the night.
Man, see, I love, man. That's, I mean, I've lived in Cali for 5 years now, not in LA. But I always just say, man, Cali dudes, if they don't have their internal beef or whatever, they're some of the nicest people in the world, bro.
Yes.
They really are. You know what I'm saying? Just very easygoing, very cool. You know what I'm saying?
Until they're not.
But you got to stay on the right side of them. If you stay on the right side of them, you're going to have a good time with Cali dudes.
Yeah, well, Oakland is just a fascinating place to be. Everything about Oakland is just fascinating and hilarious.
I mean, that's the place that built up Marshawn, Gary Payton.
There's no code switching any of the Oakland dudes.
No, man. No, those dudes are who they are, for real, for real. I mean, you know, Damian Lillard, man. You know what I'm saying? He just who he is.
Yep. They are all just like, there's no code switching them. They talk in this way that nobody else talks, right? You know, I mean, they got a Nelson Mandela Parkway in Oakland, right? Like, I went up to Oakland for a weekend once. I was like, oh, okay, y'all got Nelson Mandela Parkway. Now, don't get me wrong. The gentrification of Nelson Mandela Parkway was well underway 10 years ago. I recall the place I went brunch to. It did not remind me of Soweto. You know what I'm saying? Like they was, all right, so they were making that happen. But I remember, I forget where we were, and we rolled past this place, and it was a card house. And what I mean by a card house is, it was a place to go play cards.
What?
Like, yeah, like you could show, like want to show up and play some spades. You know what I'm saying? You want to show up and play some dominoes. Like it was a place for you to just go kick it. And it was like right down the street from the Omega Fraternity House. Like, oh, I just imagine that whole block. Like, can you imagine a room full of Oakland Qs?
Oh my God. I can't even, actually, I've never even thought of that phenomenon, because when I think of Qs, I just think of the South for whatever reason. Yes. So, like, the idea of Q's in Oakland just kind of is, like, is hitting me in a place. I'm like, what does that even look like? You know what I mean?
I bet it's hilarious. Hilarious at every turn. But the L.A. riots, that's going to be wild for people. Like, we watch people take in the O.J. trial, right? Like, when Ezra's movie came out and everything, people who were not around to try to get a magnitude of what that was. The riots, we talking about, I don't even know. I'm very curious to see how that's going to land with a lot of people.
It's just so right, man, because, I mean, so many of the issues that we're dealing with today come from then. And I mean, and they even have their foothold in the 1968 Watts riots, you know what I'm saying? So, I mean, that was a continuation of these systemic issues that they never fully dealt with, and they popped up again then. I really can't wait to dig into this. I mean, because also, I mean, just think about it. I think the Rodney King thing for a lot of us was the first time. I mean, I'm not going to say that I didn't know that the police were a problem, but to see, like, that sort of, like, raw brutality and abuse of somebody that clearly was, like, compromised. I mean, like, it's not like Rodney King was fighting. I mean, I guess it depends on who you are and what you see in that video. But I did not see somebody fighting.
I just saw somebody getting his ass whooped. I ain't never seen no other angle that indicated anything other than somebody getting his ass kicked.
It was shocking that anybody could argue anything else, but that was like a wake-up call, right? That they're just like, oh, no, you right? And also, I mean, the other thing that really got me, there were a couple other things I really wanted to get into. The Reginald Denny thing,
that was messed up.
I mean, you know what I'm saying? I mean, and the thing is, too, it lives on in a lot of rap songs. I'm talking about Ice Cube, you know what I'm saying? You know, that
is quietly one of the best lines in his whole catalog. I pull him out of his truck, hit him with it. He said, because he spun it perfectly because he made it about Charles Manson.
Right.
Because he turned the line to Charlie Manson. I pull him out of truck, hit him with a brick, and I'm dancing.
Yeah.
What are you talking about?
I mean, what? It was wild. And another thing, when I was about a couple years ago, I went to, you know, they had this like, we used to have live shows, Pop-Up Magazine had this segment or the show about Latasha Harlins. It's a director named Sophia Allison did this really good moving short story about Latasha Harlins. And like, even seeing the video from that is like, you just cannot believe that was happening. You know what I mean?
Right.
And it was like, it was a wake-up call.
And with the Harlins case, it's not just that it happened. It's that the store owner who shot her was convicted and still didn't get any time.
Right.
That was what was wild.
It's crazy. That person's still alive. in the LA area, just living, bro.
Yeah, but I'm assuming that they're not working at the same store.
The address appears to be a little different. They outside, they're not in that area, no. But yeah, I mean, man, look, see again, Ice Cube come up again, Black Korea. You know what I mean? Like, mm-hmm. There's just so much, it is rife with so many issues that were going on. And yeah, I was maybe about the age of Latasha Harlins at that time. You know, I guess when the LA riots happened, I was, you know, 13, 14 years old. And the idea that somebody could just pull out a gun and shoot you in the back of the head, bro, and to be that young, and that it not really, nothing really happened to you. Like, that was just sort of an awakening for me, man. And I don't know how I'm going to feel going through this again. I don't know why I'm putting myself through this sort of trauma, but people will be really interested to see where it goes once we finally put it all together. And it'll be interesting to see who's willing to talk, too. So,
yeah.
And history of LA is fascinating in a way that I think that people don't like really truly understand, just like how that city came to be what it is and the way it is. And I think one thing that people cannot grasp and understand about LA, it's so segregated.
They didn't want us there.
At all.
They didn't want us there.
It's not just that they didn't want us there, it's that they sold it to the white folks who came that we weren't there.
Right.
Right? They were like, yo, the best part, it's just us. That is what they sold them, is that they was going to get there from Minnesota and from Iowa mm-hmm. and all these places. And you weren't gonna have to worry about us. And we was like, whatever, we're on the way.
We want some of this too. Right.
Right. And then got there and they were like, all right, so here's what we're gonna do. We're gonna keep y'all right here.
Y'all get no one at Waterland. Yeah.
Mm-mm-mm. And wait till people find out. Wait till they start hearing about the way the cops lined up during the riots was right along I-10. Mm-hmm. They're like, you can do whatever you want south of the 10. You try to get one toe north of it. People are like, why don't y'all go burn down Beverly Hills? Give it a try. Let me know how it goes.
They won't allow us to, bro. They won't allow
you will not get that far.
Nah. And yeah, man, I It's really interesting because the other piece of it, too, is like, so a couple of years ago, I don't know if it was LA Weekly or LA Magazine. They tweeted out like one of these old maps of LA, you know, just kind of, you know, like maybe from the 1940s or 50s. And they tweeted it out and all of a sudden they had to delete it. And I was like, what happened? It turns out in one of these like very official looking maps, they had, you know what I'm talking about? They had
But I know where it's going.
They had one of these towns called Town.
That's what I was going to say. I was wondering what variation of it was going to be.
What? Yeah. I was like, excuse me? What? Oh, yeah, bro. I mean, the thing is, I always say, because I've, you know, like you kind of lived all around the country, man, and people have these assumptions about what towns are like and what areas are like. You go talk to the black people in any town, in any country here, they are fed up with racism, bro. You can go anywhere. It doesn't matter. So.
Right. And in L.A., they got conned. Yeah. Like, they was like, yo, I'm out this south. I done left Texas. Mm-hmm. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. It's about to be all right. You get out there, it's all pretty and everything else. And they're like, yeah, so let's talk. Like, you've read The War of the Mother Sons,
Oh, yeah,
right?
The doctor that came from Monroe.
That part. There's a part in The War of the Mother Sons. It is a book about the Great Migration. It follows three different families. One left Florida to go to New York. One left Mississippi to go to Chicago. And one left Texas to go to Los Angeles. It was his doctors, Morehouse dude, everything about it. He didn't leave Texas. I think he left Atlanta to go there, but he was all the Morehouse, right? All the pretension, all the worried about how things look and everything else type cat. And they said that the hardest thing about the Great Migration was getting across Texas.
Yes.
Because it was so big and there was basically no place that you could stay. And so he did the whole stay up all night, drive across Texas.
So dark, so lonely, so dangerous, that drive.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. Gets to Arizona and he tries to stay at this hotel. Nobody loves to stay at a hotel. And he gets to this one hotel, and the owner is like, look, I would love to give you a room, right? We're from Illinois. We don't agree with the ways that they get down here. We would love to give you a room, but they'll put us out of business if we wind up giving you a room. But he said, I'm here to tell you, L.A. is not what you think it is. Like, can you imagine having driven back in the day car
mm-hmm.
all the way across the country? And then getting almost there and somebody telling you, oh, no. This is going to be a colossal disappointment for you.
Oh, yeah. And also, but didn't he go up to the, I think he went to the Bay for a little bit. and then went back down to LA. And it was, I mean, it was bad in both places, you know?
Yeah.
They cordoned them off in both, you know, they had these, you know, segregated, underfunded, over-policed neighborhoods. And he went, he's like, all right, well, I'm going to LA. And it was more of the same. You know what I mean?
Well, when's the last time you watched 48 Hours? Eddie Murphy, Nick Nolte.
Oh, man, it's been, I mean, probably the 80s.
First of all, a movie that could not be made in 2020.
Oh.
That is. Because just a significant theme of the movie is Nick Nolte's flat-out racism, right? Like, the tension between the two of them is this flat-out racism, but there's a new sheriff in town scene.
Oh, yes, I remember
that. The first thing in the bar that you see on the wall is the Confederate flag. Keep it in mind, this is San Francisco.
Man, see? I mean, man, we really missed a lot. I mean, I don't... Yeah. Were you one of them people? Your parents kind of revolutionaries, bro. They never had you believing that like the police were like a non-political, you know, institution, right? You know what I mean? Because even when you're growing up, people are like, oh, I want to be a policeman, I want to be a fireman, and nobody would be like, you know, like maybe today they don't do that with kids anymore. But back when we were in the 80s or whatever, it was like, you know, that seemed like a very honorable profession. Now, I'm not saying, God, because I'm gonna have to give these damn caveats. I'm not saying that there's not honorable policemen or whatever, but it, like as an institution, it's a problem. And, you know, yeah, it just, I missed that. I missed that in 48 Hours. I missed that in all this other stuff where you had like the racist cop or whatever, or the cop that didn't deal with, don't want to have a black partner. You got this wild black partner or whatever. It's just like, oh, okay. They're kind of trying to put us on game even back then. You know what I'm saying?
Yo, let me tell you this. Watch The Naked Gun. I don't know the last time you saw The Naked Gun.
Oh,
The Naked Gun is quietly a satire on police brutality. There's a joke in there that is like, how many people does a police officer have to kill before he gets fired?
Oh, are you seeing, that's a joke in there?
Yeah. No, actually like a running gag in The Naked Gun is how these cops keep messing things up and roughing people up and killing people and nobody gets fired.
That's amazing. I got a lot of 80s movies. How do you remember all these 80s movies, by the way?
I saw The Naked Gun not too long ago. Like, it came on cable, and I watched it. And I was bored one day, and I forget which one of the streaming services. I was like, yeah, I'll go check out 48 Hours. I'm just curious. I ain't seen this in a minute.
Yeah.
You know? And I looked it up. I was like, oh, wow, this is not a comfortable watch.
Oh, it doesn't hold up.
So the thing about 48 Hours is it is not a comedy.
Right. Oh, okay.
Like when you really watch it, like there are a couple times where Eddie Murphy is funny in it.
Mm-hmm.
But if Eddie Murphy is not playing the character he plays, there are no jokes in this movie. Okay. It is not a comedy.
Wow. Okay.
And I forget who was originally supposed to be in that. Who originally was supposed to get that role? Because I don't think it was him. Like, I know he wasn't originally supposed to get the Beverly Hills Cop role. I can't remember that. Like, Eddie, we don't talk enough about the fact that Eddie Murphy kicked in the door and got a whole lot of roles that black people were simply not supposed to get.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. There was another movie like that with him. There was just like, because he did this very long, great interview with Playboy magazine in like the early 90s. Some things he says about women, as you might imagine, don't hold up very well.
Yes.
He talked about like the racism he had to deal with and like getting people to imagine him as somebody that could carry a movie, which it seems absurd now. But back then, it was like, I don't know if people are going to go see a black dude in this role. You know what I'm saying? But he had to like change people's perceptions of what that might look like, you know?
All right, so listen to this, because actually I may have been wrong. Maybe they had a different idea, but I'm looking at the wiki right now, because it was supposed to be a white cop and a black convict, right? And they were thinking that they were going to be able to put Richard Pryor in that role, and they couldn't get Richard Pryor. And then their next option was Gregory Hines. And I'm trying to imagine Gregory Hines in 48 Hours. And yeah, right, it just ain't happening. And then it rolled down to Eddie Murphy. Now, listen to this line. The character of Reggie Hammond was originally named Willie Biggs, but Eddie Murphy felt that was too stereotypical of a black man's name and changed it to Reggie Hammond. What did you think Reggie Hammond was?
Reggie Hammond. Willie, I mean, first of all, man, the 80s are crazy, dog. I mean, Willie Biggs.
Yes.
Willie Biggs.
Yes.
I mean, come on, doc.
They weren't even trying.
Wait, but do people know who Gregory Hines is? Do you, like, you said Gregory Hines, like people would know who Gregory Hines is.
That's a great question.
I don't know if people remember who Gregory Hines is anymore. He was like, it was him and Savion Glover that were the tap dancers.
Yeah, and he got that jam with Luther.
That's right. That's true. And he was in, I mean, but again, I think this was a movie from a long time ago. He was in Waiting to Exhale. You know what I'm saying?
That's right. That's right. But I do think there's a number of youth that don't. Like, think about this. What do kids know about Sammy Davis Jr.?
Oh my God. How could you even explain what he was famous for to Pete?
Right. Well, I mean, how would you explain Frank Sinatra?
Man, fair point. I can't really explain it. I know of him in relation to Sammy Davis Jr.
Well, you can explain Frank. I think you can try to explain Frank Sinatra in two ways, right? Because basically, the closest thing to Frank Sinatra since Frank Sinatra is actually Jamie Foxx. Except the difference is that Frank is primarily a singer. Like, the singing is where it starts with Frank, and then he gets into the movies, you know, and everything else. But in terms of somebody that could go do any single thing and be cool in every room that he winds up in, like, that's, to me, the closest thing about it. But the thing with Frank Sinatra was, Frank Sinatra was the coolest dude on planet Earth for, like, a 35-year period where the gangsters are out here trying to kick it with Frank Sinatra.
Oh, yeah. Right. Frank Sinatra kicked it with black folks. You know, just like even the phenomenon that he was. I mean, has anybody done a documentary on Frank Sinatra? Not even think about it?
I want to go read a bio on him now, right? Because, like, now that I sit here and think about it, because, like, we know Sammy Davis Jr. because Frank Sinatra had him in the crew. Like, Frank didn't always do all the way right by him, right? But Frank Sinatra was a kingmaker, man. Frank Sinatra out here helping determine who's going to be the president.
Yeah.
You know, Frank Sinatra's flouting the segregation rules at a lot of these places and being like, nah, Lena Horne walked through the front door. What are you talking about? She with us.
Right. Man, now I want to see it. Well, I also want to kind of see the Sammy Davis Jr. The thing I remember at this point most about Sammy Davis Jr., unfortunately, is the role he played. Well, that too. The role he played on the Cosby Show. Do you remember when he came?
Yeah.
That's just a moment in time.
But nobody could explain to me at that time why it was that Sammy Davis Jr. was somebody.
Yeah.
Like, I had no concept of what he was. Like, I just knew that everybody knew. And I also remember, too, I was just kind of like, why we keep calling him Junior if we don't know who his daddy is? Like, I remember I always been big on that. Yeah. That's where I am now with these players out here. Everybody is, you know, John Wilson III. Homie, I don't know who your dad is. It doesn't matter.
Do you know that Michael Pittman's daddy is Michael Pittman?
I did know that.
Okay. Yeah.
Like, I thought that one,
mm-hmm.
Something to it.
Okay.
Right? Like, there, like Robert Griffin III, who is the guy that started this whole thing.
Right.
Nothing to it. Yeah. I don't know who your father is. Ken Griffey Jr. makes sense.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. Man, well, I guess, you know, see, I kind of appreciate that Bronny is going in a different direction. Bronny James, you know what I'm saying?
Yes.
It's not going to be LeBron James Jr. And I appreciate him establishing his own, you know, persona.
I thought one of the coolest things that LeBron ever said, he said it on the shop once, he's like, when he had a son, he wanted to name his son after him, but he was too young to recognize what he was doing.
Mm-hmm.
And to recognize, like, the burden that that puts on his son's shoulders from here on out. Like, I thought that was an incredibly self-aware thing of him to say, just to look back on it and just be like, look, I didn't have my dad in my life. I wanted to show how proud I was, you know, to have this son. And then I realized, damn, man, there's a lot to ask.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's just, first of all, LeBron had Bronny when he was like, what, 18, 19 years old? Somewhere?
Like 20, somewhere in there.
Because, look, we'll see, Bron is 35 now.
Yeah, and I think Bronny's like 15.
15? Okay.
Yeah, somewhere in there.
Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, imagine having to be a father under those circumstances at that age. Yeah, you might be inclined to do that. I mean, people with far less to have an ego about do this all the time anyway, right?
So, yeah.
Have that sort of self-awareness is kind of cool. But, I mean, again, he got Bronny all up on TV, bro. I mean, ESPN, got Bronny TV dates.
Did we ever find out how it went for Bronny after Daddy came home, after Bronny was fired that thing up on the IG?
Hey, man, look, maybe he just was, I had to go stay with some friends, you know? He's like, I know you probably just want to get home and relax and spend some time with mom. And I'm just going to work on my game. So just give you all the time you need, Dad, and I'll show up later.
I bet LeBron didn't even say a word to him about it until after he got home. Like, I think there's like 2-3 weeks.
Yeah.
And he ain't saying, and Bronny's like, I think he might have forgot. Yeah, wouldn't that be cool?
Yeah.
I think he forgot.
Yeah, it's like, son, come in here real quick. I want to talk to you about something.
Yeah. Like just come sit next to him on the bed. Like, hey, man, I know it's been hard, you know, I know it's been tough, you know, and all of these things. And we got to talk about that video.
I'm kind of surprised because I've seen also some other TikToks, IG stories that he's been in. And I'm like, I'm kind of surprised you allow people to record you. It kind of reminds me of like what Malia and Sasha Obama was like, your friend trying to get famous off of you being in their video. I'm like,
yeah, but
I'm not going to be doing that.
But that's a prescience that at that age has got to be hard to have. And all your friends are doing this. Like, this is, you know, so Sasha Obama's problem was, like, I've had people suggest to me that I should get, like, an account that only my friends know about. And then you get, no, man, because all it takes is one.
Right.
Right. Like, everybody thinks they got somebody else they can trust, you know, that they can show this thing to or whatever it is. And then when that happens, like, the whole thing falls apart. And so I get why they want to participate and, you know, play the same reindeer games as their friends are playing. And the trouble they can get into ain't even their own trouble. It's trouble for their parents, and they don't give a damn about that. They teenagers, right? Like teenagers ain't worried about embarrassing their parents. The one thing I find interesting about the Malia Sasha thing, and I don't know how or why this is the case, but I think you're going to agree with me. Those two girls have turned out exactly as we would have guessed they would turn out when we first became aware of them.
Fair point. Yes.
In 2008.
I think I know what you're talking about. Yeah.
All of it, right? Like, you look at Malia's prom picture and you look at Sasha's prom picture.
Yeah.
That was the way that we figured that this was all gonna go. Absolutely. Right? Like, Sasha be doing TikToks to the blackity black rappity rap videos. Malia's friends do not seem to be Sasha's friends at all.
They do not probably kick it like that at all. You know
what Sasha looked like? Sasha looked like, I don't date boys at my school. Like, you know what I'm saying?
Hey, I would love to know more about the dude who took her to prom, by the way, because that dude, I just kind of was like, for some reason, I just imagined he would be like a top 40 recruit that played at Damascus Catholic or something like that. You know what I'm saying? He had that kind of a look. And I was like, I don't know why I haven't heard of this dude before, but I can't imagine that a regular dude can just get up in the White House like that.
Now, see, I don't know if the regular dude can get up in, like, the Sasha date's different than the Malia date, right? Mm-hmm. Like, the Malia date, I'm sure his P's and Q's are all, you know, in every place and everything else. But just because their daddy was the president don't mean that they ain't bringing home some of the same dudes that every woman has. I don't know a woman who did not go through that period of her life, 18 to 23, without dealing with at least one good for nothing. I don't know what it is. I don't know why it is. Right. But there's always in that space one good for nothing, and they be sticking around with them for a while.
Man, we know who dudes are, man. You know, 18 to 23 year old dudes are scumbags, man.
Yeah. That's one thing, though, right? But some rise above the rest.
He's got a resume behind it. You know what I'm saying? It's like, you're a bad person, but I can understand how you got through the door here.
You coming to holler at Sasha Obama, but it's going to be winding up like that time when Will tried to wrap that sweater around his neck and everything else to holler at that girl on the Fresh Prince. Oh, yeah. Only for her to be like, yo, I was a gangster.
Yeah, I thought you was different. I didn't think you were at Bel Air Academy.
Like, that's what I'm saying. Sasha's like, I don't date no boys that go to no Bel Air Academy.
Right. Is she the Fidwell friends?
She
can't date nobody.
Like, she might be dealing with a cat that's got some good grades or whatever it is, you know? But some dude is showing up at the White House, looked at Barack and been like, sup. Right? They brought home one dude at least, like, at their new house, who just pulled up in the neighborhood, got to the curb, and hit the horn.
He's like, hey, I'm out here. I'm ready to go.
Yeah. In fact, he ain't hit the horn because you ain't got to do that no more. He sent her a text out front.
Right. Barack is like, is your friend going to come meet me? Is he going to come to the door like a real gentleman?
Right. And I bet Barack be trying to, because, you know, he that tight. Like, he is a very masculine man, shall we say. I bet he be trying to test them young dudes just for fun.
Oh, yeah. Haven't been there. So, son, what's your plan? What do you have? Yeah. I mean, if Barack will go to a Morehouse graduation and talk about how people need to, you know, imagine how, I mean, these are people that are college graduates, you know what I'm saying? If he's going to do that with them, imagine what he's going to do with a kid that's 17, 18 years old showing up to holler at his daughter, you know what I mean?
Like, I want to ask Sasha about some of these neighborhoods in D.C. that she been in that her daddy got no idea she ever went to.
Well, I mean, the Secret Service know.
But I bet they're not telling.
Man, I wonder actually how that goes. Do they be like, hey, man, you might want to check on Sasha, dog. She was right over in the Southeast the other week. You know what I'm saying? Trying to get it in. One of these clubs, you know what I'm saying?
Yeah, like, that's the thing. Like, hopefully she would be wise enough to not do that. But no, I guarantee you, Sasha could give you the directions to some places that her father would have no idea that she knew how to get to.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It's inspiring to see that, you know, first of all, they can have these two distinct personalities in the same house. You know, and I see they see both. I mean, we just don't give them enough credit for, like, seeming to be regular. We don't know how it's going to turn out, you know. Mm-mm. But you know, they seem to be regular. I'm just like, just kind of like the other day when you were talking about people telling on Javon Wims, man. Like, don't do that to people, man. Let people be people, man. Don't. Yeah. Hit Sasha Bowman. She wants to, you know, rapidly rap, like you say, let her do it. Don't make a thing out of it, bruh. You know what I mean?
Well, I think that on one hand, that there's people that just think it's kind of cool because they are celebrities, right? Like, people are like, she is an 18-year-old. Man, we be sending stuff around that 18-year-olds do all the time. Come on now. Like, the reality is they are famous people, right? And you can say they didn't do anything to ask for it. That is true. But I also guarantee you that in the rest of their lives, they are absolutely leveraging the fact that they are the children of Barack and Michelle Obama. This is part of the trade. I'm not saying they asked for it, but this is part of the trade. We can't get around that. They're famous. People are going to be interested in seeing how they turned out, so forth and so on.
Do they have social media presences, though? Because I don't know if they have an Instagram. See, I don't think so.
Yeah, see? I don't think so, right? No, they're definitely trying to lay low, but they're trying to lay low because people are interested in them. I 100% get that, and I don't have the need to hype it up because I recognize that there's no way for them to just kind of exist, you know, in that space. But we real pick and choose about who we decide to let live, right? We take random people off the internet and put them on the Summer Jam screen every day. And ain't nobody talking about, like, we just go let them live. Like, no, they are somewhat famous people now. And this is kind of sort of what it's going to be for them.
Yeah, I mean, they didn't ask for it, but they got to live with it. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, but again, they are going to benefit from it, though.
Man.
Like, we can't act like all they're getting out of this is hassle.
That's true. I mean, I do think, though, it's not going to be the same for Obama's kids as it's going to be for, like, the Bush kids or Chelsea Clinton or whatever. I think it'll be a little bit. I don't know what their path is going to look like, and I'm not saying that they're not going to be able to benefit in some sort of way, but I do think it's going to, I don't think you'll see them getting like an anchor role on NBC News or something. They'll have a segment or something like that. They ain't going to go down that film like that.
I don't know where it's going to go for them, to be honest. Like, and by the way, them Bush girls, they could walk in here right now. I wouldn't have any idea who they were. I don't know what the hell. The only thing, last time I remember hearing about them is that time they got, one of them got caught up passing the fake ID at the bar, which is still one of the funniest stories of all time.
You know what that was? I think, wait, no, no, no. So one of them got busted at Chewy's. Another one got busted at TCU when we were in college.
Is that what the fake ID?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
Yeah. But tried to pass a fake ID, like, boo, boo.
I mean, yeah.
They know. They know. I don't know who you are. It would have worked on me.
They gonna know. But they gonna know.
Yeah. They gonna know. But keep in mind, when that happened, they were out with Secret Service. That's what I'm telling you. Secret Service ain't snitching.
That's a fair point, man. Yeah, Secret Service got their own stuff they got to worry about, too, as we've seen.
Yes, there's
like,
that.
They got their own stuff. So they're like, you keep quiet on me, I keep quiet on you.
There's that. But man, we done put in a good hour here. It's my man, Joel Addison. Check him out, Slate.com. Also, upcoming 2021, slow burn on the LA riots. And, you know, we had Josh on to talk about his slow burn season on David Duke.
It was great, man. You know, and Josh is going to be working with me on Slow Burn 6, man. That's my dude. So, yeah, we'll be going through these stories, man. And they all have, like, touchback on things that, you know, stories that are new again for us. You know what I mean? So
can we make a podcast or a documentary about just taking Josh to some of these places?
Bro.
Well, I guess he's from New Orleans.
I'm going to say, Josh got a little bit more swag than you might think. I mean, I know he got the presentation. Josh, do you know Josh is like 6'7"?
Did not.
Yeah, Josh is 6'7", man. Can't play ball.
I mean,
you thinking, if he could play ball, he wouldn't be Josh Levine. He wouldn't be doing, you know, what he's doing now. You know what
No. That's going to be dope. So check that out. And ladies and gentlemen, thanks so much for joining us here on The Right Time. We do this thing a couple times a week. Gabe Bassane, Tarika Foster, Christina Buswell handle things behind the scenes. Thank you. Remember, subscribe to The Right Time. Rate us, review us, give us 5 stars. You only give us 4 stars. I'm inclined to believe you are a hater. And we'll talk to you guys in a couple of days. Take it easy.
Thanks for checking out The Right Time with Bomani Jones Podcast.
You can listen or subscribe on the ESPN app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Right Time
with Bomani Jones.